she said. Stephen clapped a hand to his heart.
Bien sûr, mademoiselle.
Unless you counted the starring role he played in her daydreams, Céline hadn't seen Stephen since he'd graduated the academy 4 years before. Back then, he'd barely noticed her. He was too busy with his training, his girlfriend, his friends in the circle to give much thought to the slip of a girl whose eyes tracked his every move. But now, Céline thought, her cheeks burning again, they were practically equals. Yes, she was 17, still a student. Well, he was 22, not just a full-fledged adult, but Valentine Morgenstern's most trusted lieutenant in the circle, the elite group of young shadow hunters sworn to reform the Clave and return it to its pure and ancient glory. But Céline was finally a member of the circle, too, handpicked by Valentine himself. Valentine had been a student at the academy alongside Stephen and the other founding members of the circle. But unlike the rest of them, he never seemed quite young. Most of the students and teachers at the academy had thought of Valentine's crowd as nothing but a harmless clique, odd only in that it preferred late-night policy debates to partying. Even then, Céline understood that this was exactly how Valentine wanted to appear. Harmless. Those who paid attention knew better. He was a fierce warrior with an even fiercer mind. Once he fixed his inky black gaze on a goal, nothing would stop him from achieving it. He'd comprised his circle of young shadowhunters he knew to be as capable as they were loyal. Only the best of them, he'd told her that day he'd approached her at a particularly boring lecture on downworlder history. Every member of the circle is exceptional, he said, including, if you accept my offer, you. No one had ever called her exceptional before. Ever since then, she'd felt different, strong, special. And it must have been true, because even though she still had one more year at the academy, here she was, spending the summer vacation on an official mission with Stephen Herondale. Stephen was one of the greatest fighters of his generation. And now, owing to Lucien Greymark's unfortunate werewolf situation, Valentine's most trusted deputy. But Céline was the one who knew Paris, its streets and its secrets. It was the perfect moment to show Stephen that she'd changed, that she was exceptional, that he couldn't do this without her. Those had, in fact, been his exact words. I couldn't do this without you, Céline. She loved the way her name sounded on his tongue. She loved every detail of him. The blue eyes that sparkled like the sea of the Côte d'Azur, the white blonde hair that glowed like the golden rotunda of the Palais Garnier, the curve of his neck, the tautness of his muscles, the smooth lines of his body like something carved by Rodin, a model of human perfection. Somehow he'd gotten even more handsome since she saw him last. He'd also gotten married. She tried not to think about that. Can we pick up the pace? Robert Lightwood grumbled. The sooner we get this done, the sooner we get back to civilization and air conditioning. Robert was something else she tried not to think about. His grouchy presence made it substantially more difficult to pretend she and Stephen were taking a romantic stroll through the moonlight. The faster we go, the more you'll sweat, Stephen pointed out. And trust me, no one wants that. Paris in August was approximately 10 degrees hotter than hell. Even after dark, the air felt like a blanket soaked in hot soup. For the sake of discretion, they'd traded their shadowhunter gear for mundane fashion, choosing long sleeves to cover up their runes. The white t-shirt Céline had selected for Stephen was already soaked through. This was not exactly unfortunate. Robert just grunted. He was different than Céline remembered him from the academy. Back then, he'd been a little stiff and curt, but not deliberately cruel. Now, though, there was something in his eyes she didn't like, something icy. It reminded her too much of her father. According to Stephen, Robert had had some kind of falling out with his parabatai and was understandably cranky. It's just Robert being Robert, Stephen had said. Great fighter, but a bit of a drama queen. Nothing to worry about, Céline always worried. They trudged up the final hill of Rue Mouffetard. By day, this was one of Paris's most bustling market streets, bursting with fresh produce, colorful scarves, falafel vendors and gelato stands, and obnoxious tourists. At night, its storefronts were shuttered and silent. Paris was a market town, but all of its markets went to sleep after dark. All except one.
Céline hurried them around a corner, down another narrow, winding road. We're almost there. She tried to keep the anticipation out of her voice. Robert and Stephen had made it very clear that the Circle did not approve of shadow markets. Downworlders mingling with mundanes, illicit goods changing hands, secrets swapped and sold. According to Valentine, this was all the unseemly consequence of the laxness and corruption of the Clave. When the Circle took power, Stephen had assured her eagerly the shadow markets would be shut down for good. Céline had only been in the Circle for a few months, but she'd already learned this lesson. If Valentine hated something, it was her duty to hate it too. She was trying her best. There was no law that a shadow market had to be located on a site rich with dark energy, marinated in the blood of a violent past. But it helped. Paris had no shortage of possibilities. It was a city of ghosts, most of them angry. Revolution after revolution, blood-spattered barricades and heads rolling from the guillotine, the September massacres, the Bloody Week, the burning of the Tuileries, the terror. As a child, Céline had spent many sleepless nights wandering the city, summoning visions of its greatest cruelties. She liked to imagine she could hear screams echoing through the centuries. They made her feel less alone. This, she knew, was not a normal childhood hobby. Céline's had not been a normal childhood. She discovered this only when she arrived at the academy, where for the first time she'd met shadow hunters her own age. That first day, the other students had chattered about their idyllic lives in Idris, galloping horses across the Broslin Plain, their idyllic lives in London, New York, Tokyo, training under the kind eye of loving parents and institute tutors, their idyllic lives anywhere and everywhere. After a while, Céline stopped listening, drifted out unnoticed, too bitterly jealous to stay. Too embarrassed by the prospect that someone might make her tell her own story. After all, she'd grown up on her parents' Provence estate, surrounded by apple orchards, vineyards, rolling fields of lavender. By all appearances, la belle époque. Céline knew her parents loved her because they told her so repeatedly, "We're only doing this because we love you," her mother would say before locking her in the basement. "We're only doing this because we love you," her father would say before lashing her with the whip. "We're only doing this because we love you," when they set the dragonity demon on her. When they dumped her for the night, 8 years old and weaponless, in a werewolf-ridden wood. When they taught her the bloody consequences of weakness or clumsiness or fear. The first time she ran away to Paris, she was 8 years old, young enough to think she could escape for good. She found her way to the Reine de Lutèce, the remains of the Rouen Amphitheater from the first century AD. It was, perhaps, the city's oldest blood-soaked ruin. 2,000 years before, gladiators had warred to the death before a cheering, bloodthirsty crowd, until the arena and its crowd were overtaken by an equally bloodthirsty barbarian horde. For a time, it had been a cemetery. Now it was a tourist trap, yet another heap of stones for bored school children to ignore. By day, at least. Under the midnight moon, it came alive with downworlders, a bacchanalia of fairy fruits and wines, gargoyles enchanted by warlock magic, waltzing werewolves, vampires in berets painting portraits in blood, an ifrit accordionist who could make you weep yourself to death. It was the Paris shadow market, and from the moment Céline first saw it, she felt herself finally home. That first trip, she'd spent 2 nights there, haunting the booths, befriending a shy werewolf cub, sating her gnawing hunger with the crepe Nutella that a silent brother had purchased for her, no questions asked. She'd napped beneath the tablecloth of a vampire's jewelry stand. She'd whirled with horned children in an improvised fairy revel. She'd finally discovered what it meant to be happy. On the third night, the shadow hunters of the Paris Institute tracked her down and returned her home. That was when she learned, not for the last time, the consequences of running away. "We love you too much to lose you." That night, Céline had curled fetal in the corner of the basement, back still bloody, and thought, "So this is how it feels to be loved too much." Their mission was straightforward. First, track down the warlock Dominique de Foix's booth at the Paris Shadow Market. Second, find some evidence of her shady business dealings with two rogue shadow hunters. I have reason to believe they've been trading downworlder blood and parts to her in return for illegal services, Valentine had told them. He needed proof. It was up to Celine, Stephen, and Robert to find some. Quietly, Valentine had cautioned. I don't want her tipping off her associates. Valentine made the word associates sound like a vulgarity. For him it was. Downworlders were bad enough, but shadow hunters allowing themselves to be corrupted by a downworlder? That was unforgivable. Step one proved simple. Dominique de Foix was easy to find. She'd conjured her name in neon lights right out of thin air. Literally, the letters glowed brightly 3 feet above her booth with a neon arrow pointing down. Dominique de Foix le solde toujours. Just like a warlock, Robert said sourly. Always for sale. Always on sale, Céline corrected too quietly for him to hear. The booth turned out to be an elaborate tent with display tables and a curtain-off area in the back. It was crammed with tacky jewelry and colorful potions, none quite as tacky or as colorful as Dominique herself. Her hair was dyed in platinum blonde and hot pink stripes, half of it scooped into a side ponytail. The other half was crimped and hairsprayed to a hard sheen. She wore a ripped lace shirt, a black leather miniskirt, purple fingerless gloves, and what looked like a significant portion of her jewelry inventory around her neck. Her warlock mark, a long, feathered pink tail, was slung over her shoulders like a boa. It's like an Eidolon demon tried turning into Cyndi Lauper and accidentally got stuck midway through, Céline joked. Huh? Robert said. Is that another warlock? Stephen smirked. Yeah, Robert. Another warlock. The Clave executed her because she just wanted to have fun. Céline and Stephen laughed together, and Robert's obvious fury at being mocked only made them laugh harder. Like most shadow hunters, Céline had grown up entirely ignorant of mundane pop culture. But Stephen showed up at the academy full of arcane knowledge about bands, books, songs, movies that no one had ever heard of. Once he'd joined the circle, he'd dropped his love of the Sex Pistols just as quickly as he'd trade his leather jacket and frayed denim for the dull black uniform that Valentine favored. Still, Céline had spent the last couple of years studying mundane TV, just in case. I can be whatever you want me to be, she thought, wishing she had the nerve to say it. Céline knew Amatus, Stephen's wife. At least she knew enough. Amatus was sharp-tongued and stuck-up. She was opinionated, argumentative, stubborn, and not even that pretty. There were also rumors that she still secretly associated with her werewolf brother. Céline didn't much care about that. She had nothing against downworlders, but she had plenty against Amatus, who obviously didn't appreciate what she had. Stephen needed someone who would admire him, agree with him, support him. Someone like Céline. If only she could make him see that for himself. They surveyed the warlock for a couple hours. Dominique de Foix was constantly leaving her booth unattended, scurrying off to gossip or trade with other sellers. It was almost like she wanted someone to rifle through her belongings. Stephen yawned theatrically. I was hoping for slightly more of a challenge, but let's get this done and get out of here. This place stinks of downworlders, and I already feel like I need a shower. Ouais, c'est terrible, Céline lied. The next time Dominique left her booth, Stephen tailed her. Robert slipped into the booth's curtained-off area to poke around for evidence of dirty dealings. Céline was left to play lookout, browsing the booth next to Dominique's where she could signal Robert if Dominique unexpectedly came back. Of course, they'd assigned her the most boring job, the one that required nothing but shopping for jewelry. They thought she was useless. Céline did as she was told, feigning interest in the hideous display of enchanted rings, chunky gold chains, charm bracelets jangling with greater demons carved in brass and pewter. Then she spotted something that actually did interest her, a silent brother, gliding toward the booth in that disconcertingly inhuman way they all had of moving. She watched out of the corner of her eye as the robed shadow hunters studied the jewelry display with great care. What could someone like him possibly be looking for in a place like this? The scruffy preteen werewolf manning the booth had barely acknowledged Saline's presence, but he scurried straight over to the silent brother, eyes wide with fear.
You can't be poking around here, he said. My boss doesn't like doing business with your kind.
Aren't you a bit young to have a boss? The words reverberated in Celine's mind, and she wondered for a moment whether the silent brother wanted her to overhear. But that seemed unlikely. She was standing several feet away, and there was no reason for him to have noticed her.
Parents threw me out when I got bitten, so it's either work or go hungry, the kid said. He shrugged. And I like food, which is why you got to get out of here before the boss comes back and thinks I'm selling to a shadow hunter.
I'm in search of a piece of jewelry.
Look, man, there's nothing here you can't get somewhere else. Better and cheaper. This stuff is all junk.
Yes, that I can see. But I'm looking for something particular. Something I've been told I can find here only. A silver necklace, with a pendant in the shape of a heron. The word heron pricked Celine's ear. It was such a specific request, and it was something so suited to Herondale.
Yeah. I don't know how you heard about that, but it's possible we've got one of those back here. I told you, though, I can't sell to you.
What if I doubled the price?
You don't even know what the price is.
No, I do not. And I imagine you won't get a better offer, given that the necklace is not on display for customers.
Yeah, I pointed that out myself, but he leaned forward and lowered his voice.
Celine tried not to make it too obvious she was straining to hear.
Boss doesn't want his wife to know he's selling it. Said he just needs to put the word out and a buyer will find us.
And now a buyer has. Imagine how pleased your employer will be when you tell him it's sold for more than his asking price.
I guess he never needs to know who bought it.
He will not hear it from me. The kid considered this for a moment, then ducked beneath the counter for a moment and reappeared dangling a silver pendant.
Celine suppressed a gasp. It was a delicately carved heron, sparkling in the moonlight. A perfect gift for a young Herondale proud of his heritage.
She closed her eyes, allowing herself to drift into an alternate reality, one in which she was allowed to give Stephen gifts, imagining fastening the pendant around his neck, nuzzling his soft skin, breathing him in, imagining him saying, I love it almost as much as I love you. It is beautiful, is it not?
Celine flinched at the voice of the silent brother in her head. Of course he couldn't know what she'd been thinking. But nonetheless, her cheeks burned with shame.
The kid had retreated to the back of the booth to count his money. The silent brother had now fixed his blind gaze on her. He was different than the other silent brothers she'd seen. His face young, even handsome. His jet black hair was threaded with streaks of silver, and his eyes and mouth were sealed, but not sewn shut. Runes sliced viciously across each cheek. Celine was reminded how envious she had once been of the silent brotherhood. They had scars like she had scars. They endured great pain like she endured great pain. But their scars gave them power. Their pain felt like nothing because they had no feeling. You could not be a silent brother if you were a girl. This had never seemed very fair to Celine. Women were, however, allowed to join the Iron Sisters. Celine had liked the idea when she was younger, but now she felt no desire to live cloistered on a volcanic plain with nothing to do but craft weapons of Adamus. The very thought of it made her claustrophobic. I am sorry to startle you, but I noted your interest in the pendant.
It
reminded me of someone.
Someone you care about a great deal, I sense.
Yeah, I guess.
Is that someone perhaps a Herondale?
Yes, and he's wonderful. The words slipped out accidentally, but there was an unexpected joy in saying them out loud. She never let herself do so before, not in front of someone else, not even alone. That was the thing about silent brothers. Being with them wasn't quite like being with someone else, or like being alone. Confiding in a silent brother was like confiding in no one, she thought. because who was he going to tell? Stephen Herondale, she said softly but firmly. I'm in love with Stephen Herondale. There was a jolt of power in saying the words, almost as if speaking her claim aloud made it a little more real. The love of a Herondale can be a great gift. Yeah, it's awesome, she said bitterly enough that even the silent brother noticed her tone. I have upset you. No, it's just, I said I love him. He barely knows I'm alive. It was stupid, hoping for sympathy from a silent brother, like hoping for sympathy from a rock. His face remained completely impassive, but the voice that spoke in her head was gentle. She let herself believe it was even a little kind. That must be difficult. If Celine had been another type of girl, the type with friends, or sisters, or a mother who spoke to her with anything but icy disdain, she might have told someone else about Stephen. She might have spent hours dissecting his tone, the way he sometimes seemed to flirt with her, the way he'd once touched her on the shoulder in gratitude when she lent him a dagger. Maybe talking about it would have blunted the pain of loving him. Maybe she even would have talked herself out of loving him. Talking about Stephen might have become commonplace, like talking about the weather. Background noise. But Celine had no one to talk to. All she had were her secrets, and the longer she kept them, the more they hurt. He's never going to love me, she said. All I've ever wanted was to be near him, and now he's right here, and I can't have him, and in a way that's even worse. It just hurts so much. I sometimes think there is nothing more painful than love denied. To love someone you cannot have, to stand beside your heart's desire and be unable to take them in your arms, a love that cannot be requited. I can think of nothing more painful than that. It was impossible that a silent brother could understand how she felt, and yet he sounded as if he understood exactly how she felt. I wish I could be more like you, she admitted. In what sense? You know, just shut off my feelings, feel nothing, for anybody. There was a long pause, and she wondered if she'd offended him. Is that even possible? Finally, his cool, steady voice spoke again. This is a wish you should dispense with. Feeling is what makes us human. Even the most difficult feelings, perhaps especially those, love, loss, longing, this is what it means to be truly alive. But you're a silent brother. You're not supposed to feel any of those things, right? There was another long pause. I remember feeling them. That is sometimes as close as I can get. And you're still alive, as far as I can tell. Sometimes that, too, is difficult to remember. If she didn't know any better, she would think he had sighed. The silent brother she met on her first trip to the Shadow Market had been kind like this. When he bought her the crib, he hadn't asked her where her parents were or why she was wandering the crowds alone or why her eyes were red from crying. He only knelt and pinned his blind eyes on hers. The world is a hard thing to face alone, he said inside her mind. You do not have to. Then he did what silent brothers did best and fell silent. She knew, even as a child, that he was waiting for her to tell him what she needed, that if she asked for help, he might even offer it. No one could help her. Even as a child, she knew that too. The Montclairs were a respected, powerful shadow hunter family. Her parents had the ear of the consul. If she told the brother who she was, he would only bring her home. If she told him what waited for her there, what her parents were really like, he probably wouldn't believe her. He might even tell her parents she was spreading lies about them, and there would be consequences. She thanked him for the crepe and skittered away. She'd endured so many years since then. After this summer, she would return to the academy for her final year and graduate. She would never have to live in her parents' house again. She was almost free. She didn't need anyone's help. But the world was still a hard thing to face alone. And she was so, so lonely. Maybe the pain of loving someone is a fact of life and all, but do you really think that, like, all pain is? You don't think it would be better if you could just stop hurting? Is something hurting you? She summoned her nerve. She could do it. She almost believed that. She could tell the stranger about the cold house, about the parents who only seemed to notice her when she did something wrong, about the consequences when she did. The thing is, she broke off abruptly as the silent brother turned away. His sightless eyes seemed to be tracking a man in a black trench coat hurrying toward him. The man stopped short when he caught sight of the silent brother, his face abruptly drained of color. Then he spun on his heel and hustled away. Most downworlders were skittish around Shadowhunters these days. News of the Circle's exploits had gotten around, but this looked almost personal.
Do you know that guy?
I apologize. I must attend to this. Silent Brothers did not display emotion, and as far as Celine knew, they didn't feel it. But if she didn't know any better, she would say that this Silent Brother was feeling something very deeply. Fear, maybe? Or excitement? Or that strange combination of the two that descended just before a fight? Okay, I just... But the Silent Brother was already gone. She was alone again. And thank the angel for that, she thought. It had been careless, even toying with the idea of dredging her dark truths into the light. How foolish, how weak, wanting to be heard. Wanting to be truly seen by anyone, much less a man with his eyes fused shut. Her parents always said she was stupid and weak. Maybe they were right. Brother Zachariah wove through the crowded shadow market, careful to keep a few feet of distance between him and his target. It was a strange game they were playing. The man who went by the name of Jack Crow certainly knew that Zachariah was following him. And Brother Zachariah could have picked up his speed and overtaken the man at any point. But for whatever reason, Crow didn't want to stop, and Brother Zachariah didn't want to make him. So Crow strode across the arena and into the dense warren of streets just beyond its gates. Brother Zachariah followed. He was sorry to have left the girl so abruptly. He felt a certain kinship with her. They'd both given a piece of their hearts to a Herondale, and they both loved someone they could not have. Of course, Brother Zachariah's love was a pale imitation of the real, raw human thing. He'd loved through a scrim, and every year it got harder to remember what lay beyond. To remember how it had felt to long for Tessa the way a living, breathing human longed. How it had felt to need her. Zachariah no longer truly needed anything. Not food, not sleep, not even, much as he sometimes tried to summon it in himself, Tessa. His love persisted, but it was blunted. The girl's love had a jagged edge, and talking to her had helped him remember. She had wanted his help, too, he could tell. The most human part of him was tempted to stay by her side. She'd seemed so fragile and so determined to seem otherwise. It touched his heart, but Brother Zachariah's heart was encased in stone. He tried to tell himself otherwise. After all, the very fact of his presence here was evidence of his still human heart. He'd been hunting for decades. Because of Will, because of Tessa, because a part of him was still Jem, the Shadowhunter boy who had loved them both. Still loves them both. Brother Zachariah reminded himself. Present tense. The Heron pendant had confirmed his suspicions. This was definitely the man he'd been seeking. Zachariah couldn't let him get away. Crow ducked into a narrow cobblestone alley. Brother Zachariah followed, tense and alert. He sensed their slow-motion chase was nearing its end, and indeed, the alley was a dead end. Crow whirled around to face Zachariah, a knife in his hand. He was still young. Barely into his 20s, with a proud face and a shock of blonde hair. Brother Zachariah had a weapon and was quite good at using it, but he made no move to draw his staff. This man could never be a threat to him. "Okay, Shadowhunter, you wanted me, you got me," Crow said, feet braced and knife ready, clearly expecting an attack. Brother Zachariah studied his face, searching for something familiar, but there was nothing. Nothing but the pretense of brash courage. With his sightless eyes, Zachariah could see beneath such facades. He could see fear. There was a rustling behind him, then a woman's voice.
You know what they say, Shadow Hunter. Be careful what you wish for.
Brother Zachariah turned slowly. Here was a surprise. A young woman, even younger than Crow, stood in the mouth of the alley. She was almost ethereally beautiful, with shining blonde hair and the kind of ruby lips and cobalt eyes that had inspired millennia of bad poetry. She was smiling sweetly. She was aiming a crossbow directly at Brother Zachariah's heart. He felt a jolt of fear. Not because of the knife or the crossbow. He had nothing to fear from these two. He would prefer not to fight at all. But if necessary, he could disarm them harmlessly. They weren't equipped to protect themselves. That was the problem. The fear stemmed from the realization that he had achieved his goal. This search was the one thing that still bound him to Tessa, to Will, to his former self. What if today he lost his only remaining tie to Jem Carstairs? What if this, today, was his last truly human act? Come on, Shadow Hunter, the woman said. Spit it out. If you're very lucky, maybe we'll let you live. I don't want to fight you. From their reaction, he could tell they hadn't expected the voice in their head. These two knew enough to recognize a Shadow Hunter, but apparently they didn't know as much as they thought. I have been looking for you, Jack Crow.
Yeah, so I heard. Someone should have warned you. People who come looking for me tend to regret it.
I mean you no harm. I only want to deliver a message. It is about who you are and where you came from. You might find this difficult to believe, but...
Yeah, I'm a Shadow Hunter too, Crow shrugged. Now tell me something I don't know.
You here to buy or to shoplift?
Celine dropped the potion bottle. It shattered on the ground, releasing a puff of noxious blue smoke. After the silent brother had ditched her for the Hawkeye and the trench coat, the werewolf kid had shut down the booth. He glared at Celine until she accepted it was time to move on. So she'd meandered over to Dominique Dufoit's booth, trying to look innocuous, which worked fine, until the warlock herself appeared, seemingly out of nowhere.
Or just here to cause havoc, Dominique said in French.
Celine cursed silently. She had one job, a humiliatingly easy one at that, and she'd still managed to fail. Stephen was nowhere in sight, and Robert was still rummaging through the warlock's tent.
I was waiting for you to come back,
Celine said loudly and in English so Robert would be sure to hear.
Thank goodness you finally did. I'm melting in this heat.
She said that last part even louder. It was a prearranged signal, just in case. Translation, get out now. Hopefully, she could keep the warlock distracted long enough that he could slip out unseen. Where was Stephen?
Bien sûr. The warlock had a terrible accent, French by way of Southern California.
Celine wondered if warlocks could surf.
And what is it you're looking for, mademoiselle?
A love potion, is the first thing that popped into her head. Maybe because she just spotted Stephen hurrying toward them while trying very much to look like he wasn't hurrying. Celine wondered how Dominique had managed to give him the slip in the first place, if she'd done so on purpose.
A love potion, eh?
The warlock followed her gaze and made an approving noise.
Not bad, though a little beefy for my taste. The better the body, the worse the mind, I always find. But maybe you prefer dumb and pretty. Chacun a son goût, eh?
Oui, dumb and pretty, sure. So, what was Robert doing back there anyway? Celine hoped he'd managed to slip out without her seeing him, but she couldn't take the risk.
Can you help me? Love is a little beyond my pay grade, Cherie. Anyone around here who tells you different is lying.
But I can offer you. She fell silent as Stephen arrived, looking slightly harried.
Everything okay here?
He shot Celine a concerned look. Her heart pounded. He was worried about her. She nodded.
Totally fine. We're just... Your friend here wanted me to sell her a potion to make her fall in love with you,
the warlock said. Celine thought she might drop dead on the spot. I was about to tell her I could only offer her the next best thing. She pulled what looked like a can of hairspray from beneath the booth and sprayed a puff of it into Stephen's face. His expression went slack.
What did you do?
Celine cried.
And why did you say that?
Oh, relax. Trust me. In this state, he won't care what anyone says. Watch.
Stephen was staring at Celine like he'd never seen her before. He reached out a hand and touched her cheek, gently, his expression wondering. He looked at her like he was thinking, could you be real?
Turns out your little blonde friend here has a nasty case of demon pox, Dominique told Stephen.
Celine decided she was not, in fact, going to drop dead. She was going to murder the warlock.
Demon pox is so sexy, Stephen said.
Will there be warts?
He batted his eyes at Celine.
You would look beautiful with warts.
See? The warlock said.
I fixed him for you.
What did you do?
It's not obvious. I did what you asked for.
Well, it's a cheap approximation of what you asked for, but what else is the shadow market for?
Celine didn't know what to say. She was furious on Stephen's behalf.
On her own behalf, she was something else.
Something she should not have been.
Did anyone ever tell you you're beautiful when you're confused?
Stephen gushed. He gave her a moony grin.
Of course, you're also beautiful when you're angry, and when you're sad, and when you're happy, when you're laughing, and when you're...
What?
When you're kissing me, he said. But that one's just the theory. Do you want to test it out?
Stephen, I'm not sure you really know.
Then he was kissing her. Stephen Herondale was kissing her. Stephen Herondale's lips were on her lips. His hands were on her waist, caressing her back, cupping her cheeks.
Stephen Herondale's fingers were threading through her hair. Stephen Herondale was holding her tight, tighter, as if he wanted more of her than he could have, as if he wanted all of her.
She tried to hold herself at a distance. This was not real, she reminded herself. This was not him, but it felt real. It felt like Stephen Herondale, warm in her arms, wanting her. And her resistance gave way. For one eternal moment, she was lost to bliss.
Enjoy it while you can. It'll wear off in an hour or so.
Dominique Dufoy's voice yanked her back to reality. The reality in which Stephen was married to someone else. Celine forced herself to pull away.
He let out a tiny whimper and looked like he was going to cry.
First taste is free. You want permanent, you have to pay, the warlock said. But I suppose I could give you the Shadow Hunter discount.
Celine froze.
How did you know I was a Shadow Hunter?
With your grace and beauty, how could you be anything else?
Stephen said. Celine ignored him. Something was very wrong here. Her runes were covered, her clothing was convincingly mundane, her weapons were hidden. There was nothing to mark her true identity.
Or perhaps you'd like to buy 2 doses, the warlock said. One for this schmuck. And one for the other schmuck behind the curtain. Not quite as handsome, of course, but those uptight ones can be a lot of fun once they let loose.
Celine's hand crept toward her hidden dagger.
You look surprised, Celine, the warlock said. Did you honestly think I didn't know you 3 stooges were watching me? Did you think I would just leave my booth without a security system? I guess Loverboy is not the only thing dumb but pretty around here.
How do you know my name? The warlock threw back her head and laughed. Her molars gleamed with gold.
Every downworlder in Paris knows about poor Celine Montclair, wandering the city like a murderous little Eponine. We all feel a little sorry for you.
Celine lived with a steady, secret simmer of rage, but now she felt it boiling over.
I can't afford to have shadow hunters poking around in my business, so I'm still going to have to take care of you, but I'll feel sorry for you as you die.
Celine drew her dagger just as a flock of Helfus demons exploded from the tent. The winged beasts swooped toward her and Stephen, razor-sharp talons extended, beaks open to unleash an unearthly screech.
Demon pigeons!
Stephen shouted in disgust, his long sword in his hand. The blade flashed silver in the starlight as he sliced and slashed through thick, scaly wings.
Celine danced and dodged two bird-like demons, fending them off with her dagger as she pulled out two seraph blades with her free hand.
Zuflas, she whispered. Jophiel.
As the blades began to glow, she flung them in opposite directions. Each flew true, straight into a demon's throat. Both Halfa's demons exploded in a cloud of bloody feathers and ichor. Celine was already in motion, leaping through the warlock's curtain.
Robert! She cried.
He was locked inside what looked like a gigantic antique birdcage, its floor coated with Halfa's feathers, as was he. He looked unharmed and very unhappy. Celine broke through the lock as quickly as she could, and the two of them rejoined Stephen, who had managed to dispatch several of the demons, though a handful of them swooped off the ground to safety, looping and diving through the night sky. Dominique had opened a portal and was about to leap through it. Robert seized her by the throat, then slammed the blunt end of his sword down on her head with a resounding thud. She dropped to the ground, out cold.
So much for stealth, he said.
Celine, you're wounded,
Stephen said, sounding horrified. Celine realized a demonic beak had torn a chunk out of her calf. The blood was seeping through her jeans. She had barely felt it, but as the adrenaline of battle faded away, a sharp, stabbing pain took its place. Stephen already had his steely in his hand, eager to apply an Arazi.
You're even more beautiful when you're bleeding, he said.
Celine shook her head and backed away.
I can do it myself.
But it would be my honor to heal your perfect skin, Stephen protested.
Did he get hit on the head? Robert asked.
Celine was too embarrassed to explain. Fortunately, the cawing of Halfa's demons echoed in the distance, followed by a woman's scream.
You two watch the warlock, she said. I'll deal with the rest of the demons before they eat anyone.
She took off before Robert could ask any more questions.
I'll miss you,
Stephen called after her.
You're so cute when you're bloodthirsty.
Nearly 200 years before, the shadow hunter Tobias Herondale had been convicted of cowardice, a crime punishable by death. The law, in those days, was not just hard. It was merciless. Tobias went mad and took flight before he could be executed. So in his absence, the Clave meted his punishment out on his wife, Eva. Death to her. Death to the Herondale child she carried. This, at least, was the story. Many, many decades ago, Zachariah had learned the truth behind this tale. He had met the warlock who saved Eva's child, and then, after the mother's death, raised that child as her own. That child had sired a child, who had sired a child, and so forth. A secret line of Herondales lost to the Shadowhunter world. Until now. The surviving member of this line was in grave danger. For a long time, that was all Brother Zachariah knew. For Tessa, for Will, he had dedicated himself to learning more. He had followed breadcrumbs, run headlong into dead ends, nearly died at the hand of a fairy who wanted the lost Herondale to stay that way. Or worse, Zachariah feared. The lost descendant of Tobias Herondale had fallen in love with a fairy. Their child, and all their children's children, was part Shadowhunter, part Fae. Which meant Zachariah wasn't the only one seeking. He strongly suspected, however, he was the only seeker who meant no harm. If an emissary of a fairy was willing to attack not just a Shadowhunter, but a silent brother, willing to break the accords in the most egregious of ways, simply to stop his search, then surely the search was imperative. Surely the danger was mortal. Decades of quiet inquiries had led here, to the Paris Shadow Market, to the man rumored to have in his possession a precious heron-shaped pendant, a Herondale heirloom. The man named Crow, who most assumed to be a mundane with the sight, known as savvy but untrustworthy, a man all too satisfied by life in the shadows. Zachariah had learned of the pendant first. It was a Parisian warlock who'd heard about his search and contacted him with confirmation. She told him his suspicions were correct. The owner of the pendant, whatever he wanted to call himself, was a Herondale, which apparently was old news to everyone but Zachariah himself. You've known about your heritage all this time, and yet you never revealed yourself.
Sweetheart, I think you can put down the crossbow,
Crow told the woman. The psychic monk doesn't seem like he means us any harm. She lowered the weapon, though she didn't look very happy about it. Thank you. Maybe you should leave us alone to talk, Crow added. I don't think that's a good idea. Rosemary, trust me, I got this. The woman, who must have been his wife, sighed. It was the sound of someone who understood stubbornness and had long ago given up trying to fight it. Fine, but you. She poked Brother Zachariah with the crossbow hard enough he could feel it through his thick robes. Anything happens to him, and I will hunt you down and make you pay. I have no intention of letting anything happen to either of you. That's why I've come. Yeah, whatever. She took Crow in her arms. The two embraced for a long moment. Zachariah had often heard the expression, holding on for dear life, but rarely had he seen it enacted. The couple clung to each other like it was the only way to survive. He remembered loving someone like that. He remembered the impossibility of saying goodbye. The woman whispered something to Crow, then hoisted her crossbow and disappeared into the Paris night. We're newlyweds, and she's a little overprotective, Crow said. You know how it is. I'm afraid I do not. Crow looked him up and down, and Brother Zachariah wondered what this man saw. Whatever it was, he seemed unimpressed. Yeah, I guess you wouldn't. I have been looking for you for a long time, longer than you can imagine. Look, I'm sorry you wasted your time, but I don't want anything to do with you people. I fear you don't realize the danger you're in. I am not the only one looking for you. But you're the only one who can protect me, right? Come with me if you want to live and all that. Yeah, I've seen that movie. Not interested in living it. He was plenty sure of himself, Brother Zachariah thought, and felt the strange urge to smile. Maybe there was a trace of the familiar here after all. A man like me, he makes his fair share of enemies. I've been looking out for myself my whole life, and I don't see any reason I... Whatever he said next was drowned out by an unholy screeching. A giant bird-like demon swooped down, speared Crow's coat with its razor-sharp beak, and lifted him into the air. Brother Zachariah seized one of the seraph blades he had brought along just in case. Mebaia, he named it, and flung it at the bird-like demon. The blade embedded in the feathered sternum, and the demon exploded midair. Crow tumbled several feet to the ground, landing in a noisy heap of feathers and ichor. Zachariah rushed over to help the man to his feet, but these efforts were rebuffed. Crow examined the large, ragged hole in his trench coat with disgust. That was brand new! It is indeed a very nice coat. Or, it was. Zachariah refrained from pointing out the good fortune that the halfless demon hadn't ripped a hole through anything more valuable, like his ribcage. So is that the danger you came to warn me about? Saving my new coat from a demon seagull? It struck me as more of a demon pigeon. Crow brushed himself off. He darted several suspicious looks at the sky as if expecting another attack. Listen, mister. Brother Zachariah. Right, okay, bro. I can see that a guy like you could come in handy in a fight. And if you're that determined to protect me from some big, scary danger, I guess I won't fight you on it. Brother Zachariah was surprised by the sudden change of heart. Perhaps nearly getting pecked to death by a demon pigeon sometimes had that effect on people. I'd like to take you somewhere safe. Sure, fine. Give me a few hours to tie up some loose ends, and Rosemary and I will meet you on the Pont des Arts at dawn. We'll do whatever you want. Promise. I can accompany you as you tie these ends. Listen, brother, the kinds of ends I'm talking about, they don't take kindly to shadow hunters poking around in their business, if you catch my drift. Your drift sounds mildly criminal. You want to make a citizen's arrest? I am concerned only with your safety. I made it 22 years without your help. I think I can make it another 6 hours, don't you? Brother Zachariah had invested decades into this search. It seemed wildly unwise to let this man slip away with only a promise that he would return, especially given what he'd learned about the man's reputation. That didn't exactly inspire confidence in his word. Look, I know what you're thinking, and I know I can't stop you from following me. So I'm just asking you flat out. You want me to trust you? Then you try trusting me. And I'm swearing, on whatever you need me to, that your precious lost Shadow Hunter will be on that bridge waiting for you at dawn. Against his better judgment, Brother Zachariah nodded. Go. Celine had no taste for torture. Not that this was what they would call it, whatever they did to the warlock to get her to talk. Valentine had taught his circle to be careful with their words. Robert and Stephen would interrogate Dominique Dufoy using whatever methods they deemed requisite. When they got the answers they needed, names of her Shadowhunter contacts, details of crimes committed, they would deliver her and an inventory of her sins to Valentine. The warlock was bound to a folding chair in the cheap flat they were using as a home base. The warlock was unconscious, blood trickling from the shallow wound on her forehead. This was how Robert and Stephen referred to her, not by name but as the warlock, as if she were more thing than person. Valentine had wanted them to conduct this investigation without alerting the warlock to their presence. It was only midnight on their first day in Paris and they'd already screwed everything up. If we bring him some answers, he can't be too mad, Stephen said, sounding more like wish than prediction. Stephen had stopped commenting on the gamine beauty of Celine's legs and the addictive qualities of her porcelain skin. He claimed not to remember the effects of the warlock's potion, but his glance strayed to Celine every time he thought she wasn't looking. She couldn't help wondering, what if he did remember? What if, having finally touched her, held her, kissed her, he'd discovered a new desire in himself? He was still married to Amatus, of course, even if he desired Celine. Maybe even a little bit loved Celine. There is nothing to be done about it. But what if? Is anyone else hungry? Celine said. My Eva not hungry, Stephen said. He slapped the warlock sharply. She stirred but did not wake. Celine backed toward the door. Why don't I go find us something to eat while you're taking care of this? Robert yanked the warlock's hair back, hard. She yelped, her eyes flew open. Shouldn't take long. Great. Celine hoped they couldn't tell how desperate she was to get out of the apartment. She didn't have the stomach for this kind of thing, but she couldn't have them report that back to Valentine. She'd worked too hard to gain his respect. Hey, you're limping, Stephen said. You need another Arazi. He was worried about her. She told herself not to read anything into it. Doesn't even hurt anymore, she lied. I'm fine. She'd applied the healing rune half-heartedly, and it had not completely closed her wound. She preferred sometimes to feel the pain. When she was a child, her parents had often refused her Arazis after training sessions, especially when her injuries were caused by her own mistakes. Let the pain remind you to do better next time, they told her. All these years later, she was still making so many mistakes. Celine was halfway down the precarious staircase when she realized she'd forgotten her wallet. She tromped painfully back up, then hesitated outside the door, stopped by the sound of her name. Me and Celine, she heard Stephen say. Feeling slightly ridiculous, Celine withdrew her steely and drew a careful rune on the door. Their amplified voices came through loud and clear. Stephen laughed. You've got to be kidding me. It sounded like a pretty good kiss. I was under the influence. Still, she's pretty, don't you think? There was an excruciating pause. I don't know. I never really thought about it. You do realize that marriage doesn't mean you're never allowed to look at another woman, right? It's not that, Stephen said. It's the way she follows you around like a drooling puppy. That doesn't help, Stephen acknowledged. She's just such a child, like... No matter how old she gets, she's always going to need someone else telling her what to do. I'll give you that, Robert said. But Valentine seems convinced there's something more to her. Nobody's right all the time, Stephen said, and now they were both laughing. Not even him. Don't let him hear you say that. Celine didn't realize she was in motion until she felt the rain on her face. She collapsed against the cool stone of the building facade, wishing she could melt into it. To turn herself to stone, to shut down her nerves, her senses, her heart, to feel nothing. If only. Their laughter echoed in her ears. She was a joke. She was pathetic.
She was someone Stephen had never thought about, never cared about, never wanted, would never want under any circumstances. She was a pathetic creature, a child, a mistake. The sidewalks were empty. The streets shimmered with rain. The searchlight beacon atop the Eiffel Tower had gone to sleep, along with the rest of the city. Celine felt utterly alone. Her leg throbbed. Her tears would not stop. Her heart screamed. She had nowhere to go but could not go back upstairs, back to that room, to that laughter. She set off blindly into the Paris night.
Celine was at home in the dark, slumbering streets. She wandered for hours, through the Marais and past the hulking Pompidou, crossing from the right bank to the left and back again. She visited the gargoyles of Notre Dame, those hideous stone demons clinging to Gothic spires, awaiting their chance to devour the faithful. It seemed unfair that the city was so full of stone creatures who could feel nothing, and here she was, feeling so unbearably much. She was in the Tuileries, more bloody ghosts, more creatures carved of stone, when she spotted the trail of Ikor. She was still a shadow hunter, and she was a shadow hunter in desperate need of distraction, so she followed it. She caught up with the Shaxx demon in the opera district, but stayed in the shadows, wanting to see what it was up to. Shaxx demons were trackers, used to hunt people who didn't want to be found, and this demon was definitely tracking something. Celine tracked it in turn. She tracked it through the slumbering courtyards of the Louvre. It was oozing ichor from a wound, but it wasn't moving like a creature slinking off to nurse its wounds. Its giant pincers skittered at the cobblestones as it hesitated at corners, deciding which way to turn. This was a predator tracking its prey. The demon paused in the archway of the Louvre, at the foot of the Pont des Arts. A small pedestrian bridge stretched across the Seine, its railings crowded with lovers' locks. It was said that if a couple attached a lock to the Pont des Arts, their love would last forever. The bridge was almost deserted at this hour, except for one young couple, locked in an embrace, completely oblivious to the Shaxx demon slithering out of the shadows, pincers clicking together in eager anticipation. Celine always carried a misericord blade. Its narrow point was exactly what she needed to penetrate the insectoid demon's carapace. She hoped. "Gadriel," Celine whispered, naming a seraph blade. She crept behind the Shaxx demon, as steady and silent as it was. She, too, could be a predator. In one smooth, sure motion, she stabbed the misericord straight through the carapace, then slid the seraph blade into the wound she'd opened. The demon dissolved. It had all happened so swiftly, so quietly, that the couple on the bridge didn't even break from their embrace. They were too intent on each other to realize how close they'd come to being a demon's late-night snack. Celine lingered, trying to imagine it, standing on the bridge with someone who loved her, a man gazing so intently into her eyes that he wouldn't have noticed the world ending. But Celine's imagination gave out. Reality had caged her in. As long as she thought Stephen hadn't noticed her, she could fantasize about what might happen if he ever did. Now she knew. She could not unknow. Celine wiped and sheathed her blade, then crept closer to the couple, close enough to hear what they were saying. She was glamored, after all, so there was no danger in doing a little eavesdropping. What did a man say to the woman he loved when he thought no one else could hear? She might never find out if she waited for someone to say them to her. "I hate to say I told you so," the woman said. "But who knew he'd be so willing to trust a warlock? Who knew anyone would believe you were the long-lost descendant of some noble shadowhunter line?" she said, then laughed. "Oh, wait, I knew. Admit it. Deep down, you knew it would work. You just didn't want it to." "Of course I didn't want it to." He touched her cheek impossibly gently. "I hate this. I hate leaving you here. It's not for long, and it's for the best, Jack. I promise."
"You'll come find me in L.A. as soon as it's taken care of. You swear?"
"In the shadow market, at our old place, I swear. As soon as I can be sure the trail's gone cold." She kissed him long and hard. When she pressed her hand to his cheek, Celine spotted the glint of a wedding band. "Rosemary,
I don't want you anywhere near these people. It's not safe.
But it's safe for you?
You know I'm right, she said. The man hung his head and tucked his hands into the pockets of his trench coat. It looked expensive, except for the giant gaping hole torn through the left side.
Yeah.
You ready? He nodded, and she pulled a small bottle from her bag. It's better work the way it's supposed to. She handed it to her husband, who uncorked it, swallowed its contents, and tossed it into the river.
A moment later, he clutched his hands to his face and began to scream. Celine panicked. It wasn't her place to interfere, but she couldn't just stand there and watch as this woman murdered her.
Jack, Jack, it's okay. You're okay.
She clung to him as the man moaned and shuddered and finally slumped quietly into her arms.
I think it worked, he said.
When they backed away from each other, Celine gasped. Even in the dim light of the streetlight, she could see that his face had transformed. He had been a blonde with sparkling green eyes and sharp, chiseled features around the age of Stephen and nearly as handsome. Now he looked 10 years older, his face carved with worry lines, his hair mud-colored, his smile crooked.
Hideous, the woman named Rosemary said approvingly. Then she kissed him again, just as desperately as before, as if nothing had changed.
Now go.
You sure?
As sure as I am that I love you.
The man fled into the night, his coat melting into the darkness.
And ditch the trench, Rosemary called after him. It's too obvious.
Never,
he shouted back, and then he was gone.
Rosemary sagged against the bridge and buried her face in her hands, so she didn't see the gargoyle behind her blink its eyes and swivel its stone snout in her direction.
Celine suddenly remembered. The Pont des Arts had no gargoyles. This was a flesh and blood, a chiral demon, and it looked hungry.
With a furious roar, the monstrous shadow peeled itself off the bridge and unfolded a set of huge bat-like wings that blotted out the night. It opened its jaw wide and bared razor-like teeth, then lunged straight for Rosemary's throat. With shocking speed, Rosemary hefted a sword and slashed. The demon screeched in pain, raking its talons against the metal blade with enough force to knock it from the woman's hands. Rosemary stumbled to the ground, and the demon seized its moment. It leapt onto her chest, immobilizing her beneath its massive wings, and hissed. Teeth. Neared flesh.
Cereal, Celine whispered and stabbed her seraph blade through the demon's neck. It yowled with pain and whirled toward her, its innards bursting through its hide even as it tried, in its last remaining moments, to attack.
Rosemary heaved her sword and sliced off the creature's head, seconds before head and torso exploded into a cloud of dust. Satisfied, she collapsed backward, the wound in her shoulder bleeding freely.
Celine could tell how much it hurt and how determined the woman was to reveal no pain. She knelt by her side. Rosemary flinched away.
Let me see. I can help.
I would never ask for help from a shadow hunter, the woman said bitterly.
You didn't ask, and you're welcome. The woman sighed and examined her bloody wound. She touched it gingerly, winced.
As long as you're here, you want to give me an Arazi?
It was obvious the woman was no mundane. Even a mundane with the sight couldn't have fought the way she did. But that didn't mean she could withstand an Arazi. No one but a shadow hunter could.
Look, I don't really have the time to explain it, and I can't exactly go to the hospital and tell them I got gnawed on by a demon, can I?
If you know about Arazis, you know that only a shadow hunter can bear a rune, Celine said.
I know, Rosemary met her gaze steadily.
She didn't bear the Voyant's rune, but the way she had moved, the way she had fought.
Have you borne a rune before? She asked hesitantly.
Rosemary smirked. What do you think?
Who are you?
No one you need to worry about. You going to help or not?
Celine withdrew her steely. Applying a rune to anyone who wasn't a shadow hunter meant probable death, certain agony.
She took a deep breath, then carefully applied steely to skin. Rosemary let out a relieved sigh.
Are you going to tell me who sent a Shax demon after you? Celine said. And whether it was the same person who made sure an Achiral demon was here to finish the job?
No. You going to tell me why you're wandering around in the middle of the night looking like someone just drowned your pet rock in the Seine?
No.
Okay, then. And thank you.
That guy who was here with you before.
You mean the one you didn't see and won't say anything about ever if you know what's good for you?
You love him, and he loves you, right?
Celine asked. I guess he must, because there are some dangerous people out there looking for me, Rosemary said. And he's done his best to make sure they think they're looking for him instead.
I don't understand.
And you don't have to. But yeah, he loves me. I love him. Why?
She wanted to ask what that was like. How it felt. She wanted also to extend the conversation. She was afraid to be alone again, stranded on this bridge between the endless black of river and sky. I just want to make sure you have someone to take care of you. You take care of each other, that's how it works. Speaking of which, she gave Celine an appraising look. I'm in your debt now for helping me out with the demon and for keeping my secret.
I didn't say I would. You will, and I don't believe in debts, so let me do you a favor.
I don't need anything, Celine said, meaning I don't need anything anyone can give me.
I keep my eyes open and I see what's happening in the Shadowhunter world. You need more than you think you do. Most of all, you need to stay away from Valentine Morgenstern.
Celine stiffened. What do you know about Valentine?
I know that you're just his type, young and impressionable, and I know that he can't be trusted. I pay attention. You should too. He's not telling you everything. I know that.
She looked over Celine's shoulder and her eyes widened.
Someone's coming. You should get out of here.
Celine turned around. A silent brother was gliding along the left bank, nearing the edge of the bridge. There was no way of knowing if it was the same one she'd met in the Shadow Market, but she couldn't risk running into him again. Not after what she'd told him. It was too humiliating.
Remember, Rosemary said, Valentine is not to be trusted.
And why should I trust you?
No reason at all, Rosemary said. Without another word, she strode down the bridge toward the Silent Brother. The sky was pinking. The endless night had finally given way to dawn.
I had expected to find your husband on this bridge. But even as he formed the words, Brother Zacharias sensed their untruth. He had trusted a man he knew could not be trusted. He had let his sympathies for the Herondale line, his desire to believe there remained some bond between the Carstairs and the Herondales, even though this man was barely a Herondale and Zachariah was barely a Carstairs, cloud his judgment, and now it was Jack Crow who might bear the consequences.
He's not coming, and you're never going to see him again, Shadowhunter, so I suggest you not bother to look.
I understand that the Shadowhunters have given your family every reason not to trust us, but...
Don't take it personally. I don't trust anyone, she said. It's how I've managed to stay alive.
She was stubborn and rude, and Brother Zachariah couldn't help but like her.
I mean, if I was going to trust someone, it wouldn't be a cult of violent fundamentalists who get a kick out of executing their own. But like I said, I don't trust anyone.
Except Jack Crow.
That's not his name anymore.
Whatever name he chooses, he will always be a Herondale.
She laughed, and when she did, her face took on a strangely familiar cast. Familiar in the way that Jack Crow's had never been. You don't know nearly as much as you think you do, Shadowhunter.
Brother Zachariah reached into his robe and pulled out the heron necklace he bought from the Shadow Market. The necklace, he remembered, that Crow had sold without his wife's permission or knowledge, as a man might do if it were not truly his to sell. The pendant glittered in the dawn light. Zachariah marked her surprise and offered the chain. She opened her palm and allowed him to place the pendant gently in her possession. Something deep in her seemed to settle as her hand wrapped around the heron charm, as if she had lost some essential piece of her soul, and now it was returned to her.
A pigeon? She raised her eyebrows.
A heron. Perhaps you recognize it?
Why would I?
Because I purchased it from your husband. Her lips were pressed together in a thin, tight line. Her hand had formed a fist around the chain. It was clear the child at the booth had spoken the truth. She didn't know the pendant had been for sale.